Well, it must be the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness then, I suppose. We've passed the equinox and the equilux, which I didn't realise was two separate things. But now, yeah, winter is coming, as Sean Bean would say. And that can mean only one thing. It's time for the Next Voice podcast, Series 5, Episode 16. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And still to come in this marvellous, fruit-filled, misty and, you know, mellow podcast, we've got news, we've got a find, perhaps, we've got several finds, we've got some neurons to vocalise, and we have the voice of the masses, the inimitable masses. If you like the sound of that and would like to subscribe to a paper-based version or indeed an electron-based version, you can do so at linux-magazine.com and buy the words that we write there every month for Linux Magazine. Mike's nodding. You can't see it on radio, but he is. It's true. It's true. Mike would never lie to you.
I just do this anyway, but yeah. I would never lie.
Unless you get him wet after midnight or feed him. So, with that over, it's time to start the podcast, isn't it? We normally kick off with some news, which is Ben's domain.
You say that like we're not this month.
I'm confused. Well, he's right. We normally kick off with news, and we will kick off with news.
A statement of fact, isn't it, really? I'm just saying, you know, come on, Ben.
Ben, my tiny mind is melting.
You've lost the news.
Well, you still can.
Right, the news this fortnight, or however long the period is the first item of news is that there is an Atari about to be released. This is what year is it? It's
what year are we in?
Yes, I don't know. It all seems to be going wrong. Are we Atari voices?
Says, it's like being from the Labour conference. It's like being back in 1980.
Yes. So this is hot on the heels of Graham's new Amiga graphics card. We have an Atari almost available for sale, and apparently it's going to run Linux. As Ataris of yore did, apparently. it's an Intel-based box. An x86-based box, actually on an AMD processor. Going to be running a load of classic Atari games, but also apparently some modern ones. We don't yet have details on what modern ones it is going to run. My guess, because this is obviously the speculation section, is that it's going to be basically a nice Steam box with sort of detailing and make it look all retro and fancy, but play modern games. But that is pure speculation
because it's expensive, isn't it? I haven't seen any podcast notes or anything. I've just googled it. Well, at least it's being reported as being somewhere in the region of $300 US. So it's not like I initially thought when you mentioned this that it was going to be like those Nintendo, the NES and SNES reboots with, you know, basically those ARM SoCs. But it's more ambitious than that.
Yeah, it's more, as far as I can tell, and there's not a huge amount of information out about it, but it's going to be something along the lines of one of the NUCs. The Intel sort of things, but with an AMD. But with an AMD processor and, built-in graphics and that sort of thing. So it's certainly got the horsepower to play, not necessarily the latest and greatest games, but certainly fairly modern games.
It's interesting that Atari gets a lot of support now, given that the Atari Jaguar, I think, was the last console, wasn't very well received, and you know, the big video game crash in the 1980s when Atari was...
But this isn't anything to do with the old Atari, is it? I mean, I can't remember the progression that Atari's gone through in terms, but it's basically another company that's adopted the Atari brand name from...
Yeah, granddad.
Atari in the 70s and the 80s was a real thing. You know, they actually innovated slightly.
Well, true. And as a slight aside, if anybody wants to do some really funky low-level assembly programming, then try writing games for the Atari 2600, because it doesn't even have video memory. So you've got to...
Wow.
There was a book about it called Chasing the Beam, about writing software for the Atari 2600 or VCS. And basically, the electron beam on the TV is drawing things on the screen all the time. And you're in control of the processor, and you have to turn colors on and off.
Yeah.
As I said, there's no video RAM, there's no video buffer.
Yeah.
So, and when you have a vertical blank, when the laser on the screen goes back to the other side, or the beam, you've got a bit of time then to, you know, process your baddies or update a score, and the same with a vertical blank, but...
Yeah.
So, that was a bit before my time.
No, but I mean, that's kind of simple, isn't it? You could actually predict that all of those 2600 consoles were running exactly the same timing. So, you know, if you squeezed in 50 lines of assembler in between those scans, you know, every one of those consoles was going to run those 50 lines of assembler in that particular, you know, move of the beam, which is amazing, isn't it? You wish you could kind of do that now, in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can, I think it's been quite hard for emulator developers to mimic this very, it's more like an analog system they're trying to emulate there, but... No, I mean, it's interesting. Atari, let's say, doesn't have the same connotations for me as maybe Nintendo, because I was a later baby. But, and yeah, like Ben said, it doesn't seem clear if it's going to be a Steam box at the moment. I couldn't see any mention of Steam on the description.
Oh, there's none at all. I made that up.
Yeah. They could at least come with, you know, those, oh God, what do you call them? You know, how the original kind of Atari consoles came with Pong, with the, what do you call those?
Paddles.
Yeah, paddles, that's what I mean. Decent paddles. So at least there'd be something innovative about it.
Yeah.
Apparently they're launching a crowdfunding campaign later in the year, so I assume they'll release more details then. And the actual hardware should be due out early next year.
My guess is that if it can run kind of endorsed versions of Atari's original arcade games, which it will be able to do easily from, you know, great games that they were famous for, then it, especially if they can come up with some innovative control mechanism, then it might have some... I don't know, it's still very expensive for what it is.
They could have done that on, you know, an ARM chip like Nintendo have done. They must be planning something more for this. They must be, surely.
Yeah. Bundle every single Atari game from...
But that still only requires, I think, about, you know, 160K, according to sources who have downloaded them, not me.
My youth club had an Atari 2600, and I must admit, I thought it was a little bit crap even then. playing Spider-Man or whatever it was, where you climb the outside of those huge buildings, and this is probably 1980, so I'm alone.
No, was it, go on then.
Was it tape or cartridge?
That was cartridge, Atari. Yeah.
Yep. It was one of the earlier cartridge based machines. I think it came out, the original VCS came out in 78. But yeah, I think there's a lot of nostalgia there that we have for all old video games. But I think most of them on the Atari 2600 just weren't very good anyway. Yeah. No interest in playing Centipede again. I'm not even that interested in the NES Classic because, okay, Mario 3 is a great platformer and the Zeldas are pretty good. But I think the SNES just took those genres way, way, way further. So a SNES Mini I want, if any of you guys are listening, for my Christmas present.
I think, I remember now we're talking about it, the Atari 800 XL was a really good home computer. It like had a great color palette. It had like, I can only think in Amiga terms, but like an extra half bright mode for a lot of the colors, which meant that, you know, the shading was excellent. It was like the definitive machine for some games. Like I remember Alternate Reality in particular was great. And I think there was the Atari 5200 console, which was maybe based on the same hardware, the same 6502 with the same graphics kind of co-processing, which I think were really good. I think they were more popular in the US, where there was maybe more disposable income than over here in the UK. But
I seem to recall the 5200 being a bit of a commercial flop, or maybe that was the 7800, but
yeah, anyway.
It runs Linux, so that's the main thing.
Shall we move on?
Yeah.
Okay then. Next item of news this fortnight is that Mozilla has released a new Firefox thing called Firefox Quantum, which is a new browser based on the Servo engine. So this is basically a different rendering engine to the one currently used. And the main sort of thing of it is that it's far more multi-threaded than current Firefox. Everything's broken up into thousands of different parallel running threads. So in principle, it should be far more efficient on modern processors. In practice, it's likely to vary a lot depending on the websites you visit, at least until it starts to get more worn in. I'm quite excited about this. I've been following the Servo project for a few years. Around some of the beta builds, some of the really early beta builds of Servo itself. And I really like the sort of technology behind it, the fact that everything's broken down, running independently, and then sort of coming together to create the final page.
I did see this announcement today, and some of the memory usage graphs that were popping up on Hacker News, they looked incredibly impressive. I've not tried it myself, but its footprint was like, I don't know, a third or a half of what it had been before, what Firefox has been before.
So only 30 gig for a page. Yeah.
Well, hopefully it's more stable, or at least sandbox tabs.
It's a sign that they're innovating in the right direction. For ages, we criticised Firefox for getting away from their original ethos and for bloating it with loads and loads of add-ons. Like, they've had their thunder stolen by Chrome, but Chrome has decidedly not... it doesn't share the same free web values that Mozilla does. I mean, this is awesome. This is a reason for ordinary people to switch back to Firefox. Carry on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's with huge projects like Firefox and loads of others, it's really hard to make core changes because so much stuff's built on it that even small changes can have sort of huge implications down the line. Everything has to be tested, blah, blah, blah. And sort of bringing in new things like the parallelization in Servo is... Yeah, it's been years in the making, even though it's... And a lot of people criticize Firefox for not having this in the same way. Chrome's got a similar... Not necessarily similar, but it's got a high level of parallelization than regular Firefox has. And this, it sounds like sort of... It's quite hard to describe what's, all the things behind it, but it's years and years of work, of really highly skilled work to pull this all together.
I really hope it does well. I really hope it puts Mozilla back on top.
Yeah, and if it can deliver the supposed performance benefits, then it's certainly got a decent chance of doing that. Right, the next item of news this fortnight is that X11 turns 30. That's both quite impressive and quite depressing.
That's depressing.
I mean, it's obviously, it had this fantastically long life and it's been really useful, and it's done a really good job of delivering something that works across a huge range of things, because although we often think of it as a Linux thing, it's not. It's a Unix thing that has worked on, I don't know how many OSs, but a lot of them over that 30 years. But at the same time, it is just too long in the tooth now. It feels to me like we should have moved away from it already.
Well, how far have we? How many distros use Wayland by default? I'm pretty sure Fedora does now.
Does it completely now?
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't used Fedora for a while. I understood that they were the ones pushing it to be the default, but quite a few people were falling back to the X Window system.
I'm not sure anyone else does.
I'm thinking like other bleeding edge distros. I can imagine Arch has it all available, but you have to poke the right files and twiddle the right knobs to enable it.
But that's true of everything on Arch.
Well, that is true of everything, yeah. Anyway, it goes to show how how much of a job it is to replace things like this. You know, we were talking about Wayland a few years ago, and Mia, Graham and I went to interview the lead developer of Mia here in Germany. And yeah, here we are now still, and most of us using the X Window system for better or worse. I'm just shrugging.
I still think it's incredible that, we started off talking about old hardware, and, you know, we're effectively talking about code that was written at the same time as those, not far off the time of those Atari consoles and PCs, computers we were talking about, and it's still running, you know, effectively, or the design that went into it, the ridiculous design that went into it, it's still the design today, despite everything that's changed, the resolution of the display I'm looking at, you know, the graphics hardware, accelerated graphics hardware that's doing it on a machine that also has the graphics hardware, it's the terminal, it's the client, and it's the server. Always confused the hell out of me that you're sat at the server and the client is in the back end somewhere in the back room.
Yeah, that's one of those situations where they should have been sat down and just said, look, no, don't do it, guys. Just please don't do it.
I know.
It's interesting that the X Window system is the one thing that is often replaced when people make other Unix variants. You know, Apple came along, wanted to make an update to macOS Classic, Next Step and some BSD stuff, but said, no, we're going to do a different graphical layer. Android came along, loads of Linux stuff, Linux kernel and bits and pieces. No, we're going to do a different graphical layer. That seems to be a recurring theme.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing it's taken so long. It was amazing it took so long when, I can't remember how to pronounce his name, Thomas Voss.
The guy we interviewed.
Yeah. Even then, that was 4 years ago. You know,
was it really?
Yeah. Almost 4 years ago. It was 4 years ago now that we kind of, you guys were starting Linux Voice.
Yeah. You were busy. Yeah, well, maybe it's because, yeah, the X Window system, for all its flaws, has done a reasonable job. And you know, if it was so deeply broken, we may have got rid of it sooner, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. An audible shrug, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I have to think about it. 30 years ago, that's 1987. Mike, you seem to have a photographic memory of old computers. What was being released in 1987?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because there's something in my head, some old neuron in the back of my head to the left here, and it says the original goals of the X Window system were that it should work on a 3M machine. So that's 3M, so 1 megapixel, 1 megabyte, and 1 megahertz. I'm pretty sure that's right. That was the technical specification they set. So I guess around the time, apart from the wonderful Amiga, of course, and the slightly not almost as good Atari ST, the people were using the X Window system on these Sun workstations, which also had 68K processors like the Amiga and ST. Yeah, see, that was the sort of spec around the time. I had the X Window system running on a 4 megabyte laptop. Not then, I was a bit too much of a nipper, but I bought a crappy old laptop years later and I managed to get X on it. So people always said then X is so bloated and bad, but yeah, I had it.
I think Appetite for Destruction came out in 1987 as well.
Was it Violator? I'd have to Google it.
Violator was 1990.
Oh, no! What a fail. Okay.
Back in many years after 1987.
Okay, then, that New Order Substance collection, that was really good. That must be
1987. Probably. Still glad that they've settled their legal battle now.
Oh, God. It's terrible, isn't it?
All these years, what a silly thing. Like Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. Silliness.
It's sad. Yeah.
Okay, should we move on with the Linux news?
Yeah, sorry.
And that next up on our Linux news is that there's malware, or there has been malware typo squatting on PyPy. So if you're a Python user, or just somebody who uses bits of Python software, you may well use pip to install stuff. And what some nefarious folks have done is put sort of badly behaving software into the Python repository in a name very similar to legitimate software. So, for example, there's a legitimate bit of software called urllib2. They've put it in as urllib. So if you make a mistake when you're typing it, instead of getting the software you want, what you actually get is the malware. It's not entirely clear what it's been doing, but it appears to be hoovering up some data and sending it off to a server somewhere. And it's because we're getting into a sort of situation where we're quite used to using online repositories. I know, you know, you probably apt get stuff or yum install stuff or etc. And yeah, there's node stuff. And you just get so used to some whatever install software, and you kind of forget that that's not necessarily a secure way of doing things. And it varies a lot between package managers. Some have some form of checking. So typically in Linux repositories, if you yum or apt-get something, somebody should at least have checked that that's moderately sensible software and nefarious software doesn't get in there. In other repositories, they just let anyone upload stuff. And if you download stuff that's got malware in it, that's your problem.
Yeah, it's like I see more and more often now, especially on forums around the web, you know, when people are talking about Linux or asking Linux questions, solutions like use curl to download this script and pipe it into sh, you know, to install the latest shiny thing to get your latest Docker or whatever. And, you know, it's exactly the same as double clicking a random exe file in Windows, or maybe a bit slightly safer if something can only affect your home directory, but it's still, I feel we're going down a bit of a dodgy alley there.
I love the way that you've just got like a list of things, of pet hates that you just throw into sentences like that, like Docker. It could have been immigrant or anything, but it just happened to be Docker.
I got to admit, I don't quite understand what Docker does or why it's
even if it's installed with a curl command.
To be fair, anything can be installed with a curl command if you pipe it into sh.
Yeah. Other programs are available and may also be bad.
My own personal thing on that, pet hate on that, is, as you said, it doesn't, it can't necessarily alter everything if you don't use sudo, if you just pipe into sh. But I that's actually not true. If it can affect your home instance, it can overwrite the sudo command or override it, yeah, and can then manipulate you when you do use sudo for something else. So yep. Even if you think, oh, I'm not using sudo, it can't make all these changes, it actually can, and it will just hijack it the next time you use sudo.
Yeah, I think there's an XKCD comic about this Unix home directory security, isn't there, saying how, like, well, yeah, this you know, random program can delete all my files in my address book and send email to my address book and do X, Y, and Z, but it can't change my message of the day.
But the thing is, it can change your message of the day, Mike.
Oh, my naivety, you see.
But it, yeah, I mean, is that any more secure or insecure than doing a pip install when there's no checking in the pip repositories? Or for that matter, a Docker install when there's no checking on the Docker repositories?
Yeah, is there any checker on docking repositories? Docking? I'm thinking Frontier again.
If memory serves, there's two styles of Docker repositories, and one, they have like the official repositories where they do, and there's the unofficial ones where they don't. But one of the issues with Docker is when you're installing stuff, you get such a mess of a huge amount of stuff, there's no way anyone would notice if there was malware in there. You just get it.
Yeah.
Apparently in Elite Dangerous, today we're recording this on the Tuesday, the 2.4 update is being released today, and that one reintroduces the Thargoids.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Ba 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 ba. Yeah.
I have no idea what's going on.
Well, you will soon. You won't be able to escape it.
Ba
tingling at home.
Do they attack you if you pipe curling, Tisha?
But when are planetary landings coming, Graham? That's the thing I've been waiting the last 12 years for.
I don't know.
Or however long.
I don't know. I mean, there's no witch space either. So did you get witch space in Frontier? In the original Elite, it was the Thargoids were in witch space.
Was witch space when you do a jump and it goes wrong?
That's right, yeah.
You could have missed jumps in Frontier, but they wouldn't put you anywhere. Well, you're supposedly in the middle of nowhere, but you can't see anything. Right, yeah, right. You just have to then jump into another system.
So I'll have to fire up Elite Dangerous and see if I can see some Thargoids and, I don't know, make peace with them because everybody else will be trying to shoot them.
You're like Picard.
Well, when I first played Grand Theft Auto, you know, I spent ages obeying the traffic lights and trying not to run anyone over. It's true. It was
Did you know
fun.
You had
it
to
was
do
more,
that?
It was just more fun. It was my
There must be some speedruns on the net of people playing through GTA 3 with, like, not killing any really slow 25-hour so-called speedrun.
Well, the thing that destroyed it for me doing that was that sooner or later you have to come to a mission where you have to do something like that. You have to, like, kill some innocent bystander.
Yeah,
that's when I stopped playing.
Really?
Well, I just drive around the city at night and, you know, be satisfied with that.
Right, we have one more item of news. If I can claw this news section into news.
It's been a lot of retro gaming in this one.
Cool. And that's that there is an official Manjaro laptop launched by Station X, which we mentioned a couple of episodes ago, I think. They're a new Linux hardware manufacturer.
Oh, cool. Is there anything Manjaro specific about it, or have they just, you know, swapped the image?
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's just been tested to work on Manjaro. It doesn't have a specially designed CPU optimized for...
Manjaro.
Yeah, whatever it is Manjaro is optimized for. Things seem to be getting a little bit more common, the sort of distro... hardware tie-ins, and I think it seems like generally a good thing to me. If you use Manjaro, you want a laptop and you want to know that it will work with Manjaro, there you go.
I think it's a good thing. It's better than, you know, buying 200 cheap laptops from DL Extreme and then, you know, trying to sell them to your friends and not knowing whether it works with the level of Linux you want to put on it.
Yeah.
That's oddly specific there. What happened, Graham?
I'm in my imagination, that's what this is, you know. It's like, you know, a group buy from whoever makes the laptops initially and making sure that the hardware works with Linux and then, you know, reselling them.
It does seem pretty cool. My main concern would be, will it work with future releases of Manjaro? Like, I don't know the Manjaro release cycle, but if you buy it and then you upgrade it in 6 months and something start breaking, then maybe that's a very pessimistic way to look at it, but things to bear in mind.
It's pretty rare to lose support for stuff on upgrades, isn't it? I don't think that's ever happened to me.
No, you're right. Something shouldn't be disabled unless, of course, it's a Sony console. You're right. I'm probably just being paranoid again.
Are the hardware manufacturers queuing a path at your door to release a macOS official laptop?
I probably could do that, but you see, I don't need to because macOS works on anything I've tried it on. Because all it needs is a 16-bit processor and 1 megabyte of RAM, then, you know, it's the universal operating system. Debian can do one.
It also needs a BIOS, Mike.
Yeah, but Can the UEFI emulate a BIOS? If not, then that's the end of macOS. So,
You need a secure boot macOS.
Oh no! I'll do a Kickstarter. They seem to be really common these days. Yep.
And on that bombshell, it's the end of the news.
Right, so it's now time for finds of the 3 weeks. I'm going to dive straight into IRC because it's been 3 weeks, there's people have been sharing their finds all day. So this is the Linux Voice channel on Freenode. James Olympus, is it finds time now? Yes, it is, James. I have two finds. One less interesting find. Okay, thank you. Is the command line tool DTRX, which stands for Do the Write Extraction. It extracts any archive into a new directory named after the archive.
That's really cool. Yeah. I think I've seen similar tools before like that, but also if it avoids doing any tarballs, which is where you extract and it throws everything in your home directory.
Cool. Yeah, that is really cool. And we can't avoid retro tonight, Mike. A retro find from James Olympus, the Varievo Spectrum Emulator, or Varievo Spectrum Emulator.
Another great name.
I've tested it on an old laptop with 33 megahertz, 486, and it runs at full speed as far as I can tell. Wow. There's an interesting...
Varievo like Sarajevo?
No. It's, well, no. It's got a W. Just, it starts with a W.
Yeah, but the rest of it's like Sarajevo.
Yeah, kind of.
Might be some reference. 33 megahertz to emulate a, 4 megahertz machine. That's pretty good going.
Yeah, but I remember... I used to think that when I never really had a 33 megahertz. I used to have a turbo button, so it went up to 66, remember, and then 80 when you got like Cirrus Logic CPUs. And they still couldn't emulate, you know, Commodore 64 or something effectively, although Frodo did do that.
I never understood the point in turbo buttons. When would you not want to press a turbo button?
I don't know.
No, there was a reason. If you needed to go back to an older CPU speed, because games were programmed to match that CPU speed. Some games back in the day were written not to adapt to different CPU speeds, but just, this is for 25 megahertz 486s. You buy a faster PC, the game, you know, screws up and plays terribly or plays too quickly, you disable your super funky hot turbo button and life is normal.
Surely then you'd want a slow button, not a turbo should be the default.
Well, I think it was. If the button just disabled turbo to run the old games.
I know what Ben's saying.
Yeah.
Pressing turbo implies that it's for an extra when what it should be is default and it should be, you know, economy mode. I haven't played with a Spectrum emulator for some time, but I have to try it. I was sport for emulators because on the Amiga you could get like Shapeshifter, which was that software Mac OS emulator, Mac OS, you know, the 68K emulator at the time ran, the version of Mac at the time, I can't remember, version 6 or 7, almost perfectly.
Well, I guess that was a 68K machine emulating a 68K, and I wonder if there was some sort of VM tricks there, so it wasn't just emulating, but doing some...
Well, I think, as I remember it, you needed to have the... Oh, God, what's the memory? The MMU.
MMU.
That's right, and so it basically had the... what's the ROM equivalent in a Mac to the kickstart? It had the Mac ROM being accessed via the MMU natively from the software running in the emulator. And now, as much as I remember, I think the guy that wrote Shapeshifter also wrote Frodo, the Commodore 64 emulator. I used to be able to remember his name, but I can't. Anyway, I was very disappointed on the Amiga that I could emulate in a Mac, but I couldn't emulate C64. Now, what else do we have? John the Nice Guy, the BBS software that most radio amateurs used in the 90s and early 2000s on the AX25 network. Packet radio is packaged for Ubuntu and still runs. It's called FBB. I don't know anything about this.
Does that mean it's a BBS that runs over the radio?
I guess so. I guess you could, you know, I don't know, to a serial port and access BBSs via that way.
That's quite cool.
No. Is that the same as ham radio?
I think so. I think so, Mike, but this is a different world for me.
I don't know.
Now all I need to do is dig out my old radio and find a working TNC. So, skip through the finds. Find. This is from Ian Gogo. A find from not too late. UWE in Bristol got annoyed with commercial e-assessment solutions, so developed their own. He provides a link. Don't know if this should be shared, but it's interesting. Okay, cool. It's GNU licensed, but it's a request. I'll have a look before I put the link in there.
So UWE is the University of the West of England.
Okay, sorry, I didn't know that. So Enorm, one of my mates does awesome bass only covers of computer game tunes. We can't escape it. Latest is Tetris, but also Turrican 2, Sonic, and others. So these are bass only cover versions of these. I listened to them earlier on. Enorm's friend is called Beardy Bassman, and you can find him on YouTube along with all of his covers. Devilment FOT, Finder the Fortnite, there's a dot screen RC option you can set net hack on that changes screen's error messages to be, well, more net hacker like. That's definitely worth a try if anyone's still using screen. And Degville, I can't remember if this has been mentioned before. This is from McPhail, but BrewDog have released all their recipes as a share, in a share alike fashion. We have mentioned this before, but it's always worth re-mentioning. That's Ian Gogo. And I think that's about it, actually. There's plenty of finds there from the IC channel. I'm sorry if I've missed a few out. It's difficult to go through it. Does anyone else want to share a find?
I can have a...
We should come up with an order. Yeah, have a go, Mike.
The first one is, apparently there was a Heineken version of the GameCube. I know we're going back to video games again now, but, you know, it's... Yeah, they're very, very rare, and all they are is GameCubes with Heineken stickers on them. But some Nintendo fans were talking about it recently and said there was only like 50 or 100 of them made, and people are trying to get hold of them. I guess they're quite easy things to fake, and Heineken just gave them away in a promotion because, you know, normally an alcohol company and Nintendo wouldn't really be good bedfellows, Nintendo being super family friendly and everything, but... Yeah, again, listeners, if you can confirm whether that's real or I'm just going mad, let me know. But the other find is a lot more actually potentially useful and Linux related. And team, if I were to ask you, name a package of command line tools for manipulating graphics files, what would you say it is?
Image Magic.
Everybody says Image Magic, right. Graphics Magic... Has anybody heard of Graphics Magic?
No, but I bet it's not spelled correctly.
It also has the same silly ending, but...
Is it spelled this is what it's the Crowley way?
This is what it says on the Graphics Magic website. Graphics Magic is originally derived from Image Magic 5.5.2 as of November 2002, but has been completely independent of Image Magic since then. Since the fork, many improvements have been made by many authors using an open development model without breaking the API or operation. It's more efficient and gets the job done using fewer resources. It's smaller and lighter, 3 to 5 times smaller. It's used to process billions of files on the world's largest photo sites like Flickr and Etsy. It's has fewer security issues. It passes Valgrind check 100% clean. It comes with a comprehensive manual page. It provides detailed yet comprehensible changelog and news files. So that's from their website, and they're obviously very keen to position themselves way ahead of Image Magic. But it's interesting. Maybe Graphics Magic is a way, way, way better set of tools. And if Flickr and Etsy are using them, then you know, that's pretty good accolades. And yet, none of us have heard of it.
No, that's true.
It shows how strong branding is.
Yeah,
you know, you think of some things like X386, and everybody moved over to Xorg pretty quickly. All the developers moved over when X386 had its problems, and ever since then. Because it's a technical piece of software, everybody just uses Xorg. You look at the situation with OpenOffice and LibreOffice. Okay, most of the developers moved to LibreOffice, but OpenOffice is still a well-known brand. But in this case, everybody in the world, well, everybody in the Linux world knows Image Magic, and it's the first thing you download if you wanted a bunch of command line image manipulation tools, and yet maybe, just maybe, this graphics magic is way ahead in many areas, and they just don't have the mind share for some reason. So again, listeners, if you know graphics magic, or you're using it, or you use image magic a lot and you test it out, let us know what you think, because it's obviously a decent piece of software if Flickr's using it.
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. Anyone else want to share one?
Hell no.
Do you want to go for it, Ben?
Okay. Yeah. I've got to find this. Well, the last few weeks, the last few years, to be honest, I've been working on this system for watering my garden and that sort of thing, and it's slowly coming together. And one thing I wanted was a display board so I could see, you know, the weather forecast, whether or not the automatic watering system was due to come on, everything sort of mashing together and all that. And I could have just used an old monitor or a tablet or something like that, but I didn't want a computer screen. I wanted a way of showing this information that was a little slightly more analog, slightly more real than a sort of screen. So I've decided to get some circuit boards printed, and on the circuit boards have the symbols and have lights on the different bits of the symbols so you can see things coming on. And I'm going to do this in parts because, to be honest, I don't really know what I'm doing. So I've done the first part, which is a sun, and with like the sort of classic sun pictures. So you've got the circle in the middle with like the rays of the sun going out, and each ray of the sun represents a day. And there's two light LEDs on each ray showing whether it's forecast to be sunny in the morning or the afternoon. And I designed this PCB in KiCad, and I sent it off to be printed. And just as we were coming on the podcast, I got an email saying that the PCB had been printed and it was being shipped back to me.
Wow.
So there's also an I2C port expander on the PCB, so it can drive the LEDs off an I2C signal. I haven't quite worked out exactly what the sort of the overarching brains behind the project is going to be. It could be an Arduino, it could be a Raspberry Pi, it could be any of these. But yeah, I'm going to have those, and I'm going to have a set of these different PCBs to show different bits of information.
That sounds brilliant, Ben. It sounds really good.
I have genuinely no idea if it's going to work or not.
Is it expensive?
It varies. So Oshpark, which is the service I used, charge, I think it's $5 per square inch.
Right.
And that you get three copies for that. And there's a few other services around. That includes postage and packaging.
Yeah.
And there's sort of various other services around. Some of them are quite a bit, or appear to be quite a bit cheaper, but don't include postage and packaging. But you get more PCBs. So there's another one I found, and Dirty PCBs worked out at about the same price, including postage and packaging, but you got 10 copies. But to me, that's completely useless.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd go with Oshpark.
Oh, that sounds so cool. I really like the I've actually got a load of stuff that I have plugged in all the time that are basically a web of cables. You know, especially around Arduinos that I've got doing a couple of things with synthesizers, and it would be great to just, you know, basically sketch down what those cables are connecting and create a simple PCB for it. Nothing to do with I2C or anything like that.
And this was it's the first time I've ever done anything like it, and it was fairly simple. So you just start off by drawing the schematic of the circuit, and then you sort of give each part its sort of physical thing, because there's different packages, the same component can come in, and then it's just a drag and drop thing. It's not wildly complex. As I say, it may have been wildly complex, and I've completely misunderstood what I was meant to do.
You'll have to tell us next time how it works.
Yeah, I will do. Hopefully by the next podcast I'll have one I can show you.
Awesome. Shall I have a go? I've got one all audio find. I'm sorry. But it's just too good. I can't not mention it. It's called VCV Rack. And it's basically, it's an open source modular synth Should I talk about modular synths at all?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure I've talked about this before. Modular synths are like how synthesizers started in the 50s and the 60s, in that there was never like an entire unit that made a sound. You had to put lots of different modules together, the modules in modular synth. So there would be something that made a sound, an oscillator. There would be something that modulates the amplitude of the sound, a VCA, combined with envelopes to change the contours of the sound, and a filter to change the spectral content of a sound, and lots of different things that like the BBC Radiophonics workshop would use to create their sounds. And all of these things would come together, and there'd be some output, and somebody would program these things by patching them with patch cables like analog computers. Bob Moog basically made them a little bit redundant by putting an oscillator in one place, a filter in another place, a mixer in another place, and combining it all into his first Moog Model D synthesizers, the Mini Moog, which has basically become the format for all synthesizers since then, packaged in a keyboard with everything involved.
I thought it was pronounced Moog, so I'm learning something here.
Well, lots of people do pronounce it Moog, yes, because it's spelled M-O-O-G, but it's Moog. In fact, one of Moog's synthesizers was the Moog Rogue.
Cool.
But anyway, modular synthesizers were expensive and niche until 10 or 15 years ago. A form factor of modular synth for DIY people, really, called Euroec, became very popular. Actually popularized in Germany by a company called Dörpfer, who make really cheap, low-cost Eurorack modules for creating these old systems in the comfort of your own home. But since then, integrated chips and people printing their own circuits, there's been a massive, massive boom in small, you know, a couple of people making Eurorack modules. That's what they're called, modules. I've actually got a small one I was going to show. If I show you my small little Eurorack thing.
Okay.
Is this going to work?
I see lots of wires. We see lots of cables.
So that's what it looks like.
Hang on a minute. Just hold it still, Graham. Okay, I got the screenshot. We can put it in the podcast.
I don't suppose that's terribly clear, but these things here are different modules that you wire together to make different sounds. Right. So the reason why I say all that is that somebody's created all of that in software. There's been like software versions of modular synthesizers for a while, but the really interesting thing about this, and it's called VCV Rack, is that it actually is capable of hosting the real modules in software, because many of these modules have open source firmware running on ARM chips. And the small companies that make this hardware make all of their firmwares available for free, and basically if you combine that with a bit of clever software engineering to emulate the actual components on the circuit board with the open source firmware, you get exact duplicates of this Eurorack hardware in software. And that's exactly what VCV does. It not only is it like a completely open source modular synth, you can also use it to host real, well, the software equivalents and unofficial versions of the same modules. I've actually got a couple of the modules that they emulate because they're so good, and it's like the find of the year if you're into audio. It's incredible. It's an incredible piece of software. Worth supporting the people that make the Eurorack modules as well, because it's because they've made their firmware available for free that it's possible to do this. But it's, if you've got any kind of desire to get into audio, it's brilliant.
I just love the geekiness of it. I know very little about audio, but just like hopefully listeners reading about the Atari 2600 programming being completely crazy, that it's just fantastic geeky stuff.
My other find. This was released, Firefox Focus. Has anyone tried it on their mobile?
Never heard of it in my life.
It's basically, I think it was released a couple of weeks ago. It's another thing out of Mozilla, the Mozilla Foundation. It's basically a privacy-focused version of Firefox that is a single tab in a single application that loads up. It's very lightweight, very quick, and then as soon as you close it, it's closed and your web session is gone. So there are no tabs. There are no bookmarks unless you save URLs to a folder on your Android phone. And I've switched out my old Firefox, which used to have 40 tabs open on Android, and I just use this now. The privacy thing is good, but it's really nice to just be kind of disciplined and not have a million tabs open and open up pages on the phone, check them, and then close them again and make links if you need to. It's a really great app.
It sounds like one of those extensions for a kiosk mode.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I remember writing about this a million years ago. But yeah, basically disabling everything so that if you were setting up Firefox in a university or museum or something and you didn't want the kids going onto 4chan and other lulzy websites, then yeah.
Yeah, it'll load up any URL. But it,
yeah, okay,
it doesn't,
so it's not a filtering thing.
Yeah, just, no, it doesn't have any of the, it just basically renders the web page, works for the session. It's like private mode for a session. And when you close it, it loses all the history, all the cookies, all the the clipboard stuff, everything.
Does that mean, are you still using, oh, sorry, Ben.
Does that mean I'd have to remember all my passwords?
I've not, probably, unless you use, I don't know if it works with KeePass or something like that. I use password store on Android, so I'm used to copy and pasting my passwords out of that. And my final find is to do with home automation, and it's I use a Logitech Harmony smart hub for sending infrared signals to the amplifier and the television, and I may have mentioned this ages and ages ago. It's a very closed shop. There aren't any APIs, and Logitech doesn't really give you access to the way that it sends infrared signals or anything like that. So I've discovered Harmony Hub CLI, which is basically a reverse engineering of the protocol used to communicate with the hub. And from the command line on Linux, you can send commands. In the world of Harmony remotes, you can send activities to turn on your TV, which will also turn on your amplifier and switch to the right channel. But you can also send discrete signals, remote signals, for any of the devices that you have. It works really well in a home automation context because you can use it from like Domostitch, which is the home automation software I use, to, you know, turn on the radio when you get up in the morning, or change to a specific channel without having to go through Harmony. The main thing is that this hasn't been updated for a couple of years. It requires Logitech authentication token, but you can comment that out of the C++ source code and it still works because it's no longer required by Harmony. And it seems to, it doesn't correctly probe all of the device infrared codes from your Harmony hub. So it doesn't give you a list of commands you can send, but if you use the command to generate the raw output, all of the codes are there. I can make a write-up for that, but it still works, and it's really useful if you've got anything connected to Harmony that you want to control outside of Logitech's little app ecosystem. They're my finds. That leaves Andrew, if he's got anything. That sounds all right.
Okay, very good. Well, my find is, I'm conscious of the fact that it's 5 to 10 and we need to press on and I need dinner, but my find is, it's on YouTube and it's a video by The National, which is a band, and it's them performing on the steps of the Sydney Opera House, and it's lovely. That's it. They're just, it's not a boy band, they're a man band. They're all in their 40s and they sound like they should be singing in a dive bar through in a West End town with a glass of whiskey and a broken-hearted love songs all around them. I think it's absolutely wonderful and everyone should listen to it.
Can I ask if you have any news on your appearance on national television?
Yes, I have no news on my appearance on national television. I'm so sorry. I was back at the BBC again a couple of weeks ago. The food is absolutely superb.
Oh,
That's all I can say. The little lamb and chorizo skewers, just so good.
Only for winners, though.
I can't say if they're only for winners. Can't say.
That's where the license fee money goes. Then is it on these fancy little?
Little knickknacks. like a grilled bit of ciabatta with a really soft scoop of goat's cheese and then half a fig with a drizzle of balsamic vinegar. That's where your license fee goes. Not yours, Mike, obviously, because you don't pay UK taxes, do you?
I pay the German license fee so I can watch Sturm der Liebe, a very good program.
That's good for you, but you can't really, well, anyway.
Okay, thanks everyone. They were our finds.
Wonderful, and it's our halfway reminder. Still to come, there may or may not be a vocalizer on Neuron, but there definitely will be a voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this and would like to hear it in a more readable, less hearable fashion, you can subscribe to Linux Magazine at linux-magazine.com.
We are pressing for time, but fortunately, the Neuron this episode is very quick. Because I had email problems, I get my neurons delivered to me via Graham. So Graham forwarded me this neuron, and this neuron contains a question for Graham. So
that's it for me.
Everything makes sense in the end. The neuron is from a guy called Digger, or maybe a girl called Digger. Says, Graham, I understand Mike looks at his emails infrequently, so I wondered if you would consider this question. Now that MP3 is no longer evil, will this sound the death knell for the OGG format? Great show. Love the varied discussion topics. It's a pleasure to listen to people who understand and care passionately about free software. So in 18 words or so, Graham, do you think OGG's going to die now that MP3 is
allowed? It's a good question, actually, now the patent has expired on MP3. No, I don't think it will. I think, I don't think it will.
I mean, OGG's a technically superior file format.
Yeah. The quality is better generally. I don't know about the resources, but I imagine we need something else, really. You know,
FLAC. We've all got 20 terabyte hard drives now, haven't we?
Yeah, maybe FLAC.
I don't, but anyway, thanks Digger for that awesome neuron. If anybody else has a neuron to speak to ask Graham questions, they can send it to Graham. Or you can try sending it to me, but it may not work. So graham.morrison at
graham@linuxvoice.com.
Right, that now brings us to the voice of the masses. Our question this fortnight / 3 weeks is, what's your getting things done tip? In our last podcast, we talked about Emacs' famous org mode, an insanely powerful tool for doing pretty much everything. Check out the comments in a link for more feedback from listeners about why org mode rules. And also, try not to have nightmares about Graham's really weird illustration that he did. For our next podcast, which is this podcast, we want to hear more tips. What FOSS software do you use for getting things done? Are there specific tools or apps that help you battle through your daily work pile? Have you found a hidden gem you want to share with the world? Or do you simply have a file called notes.txt on your desktop with everything inside? That's me. That's what I do. Yes. Okay, so let's kick off with Javier. He says, just one tip. Don't spend the whole day fiddling around, testing new distros, and do some work.
Someone's been spying on me.
John the Nice Guy, I have a few different things, which probably isn't helping. Au contraire, John the Nice Guy, a few different things does help. Gmail, he says, multiple inboxes, lab enabled. Search criteria set for the second inbox to is unread hyphen in inbox. Okay, not sure how that works. Filters for all emails not sent directly to me to be auto-archived and labeled for things I send to check frequency. Archive mails as soon as any actions are completed. That sounds useful. Number two, Google Calendar plus Trello via IFTTT. Anything reoccurring that needs a present being bought, e.g. birthdays as an extra reminder 1 month ahead of the date. Brilliant.
That is very on Trello, that's very cool.
That is awesome. The presence of this calendar entry triggers an IFTTT to add the reminder to my Trello board. Trello, basically everything else shared between my wife and I.
I don't think I could have my relationship reduced to a Trello board.
I hate Trello. Really hate it. Willem says, I really like Task Warrior. It allows you to adopt a getting things done style. Use the sync server and the Android app to have access to your to-do items everywhere. Graham, you're nodding. Have you used Task Warrior before?
No, I haven't. No, I've played with it, but I've tried all kinds of things to get organized, and I'm basically just disorganized. I have to just embrace it.
Okay. Graham W. says, remote server management over SSH. Midnight Commander licks them config files into shape. I'm not sure that's a sort of methodology hack. However, Peter has the ultimate methodology hack with his answer, boredom. Don't fill the gaps in the workday with random news and entertainment. No, but he's right, isn't he? He's so right.
Reddit, hold my beer.
Make sure you are longing to do something productive. Take breaks and make sure it's a break from brain stimulation. That's so right. I learned a phrase the other day, ludic loop. So I think maybe the last time I was down at your place, Graham, I'd heard on the radio the phrase homo ludensis. So that's the idea that we are, that, you know, humans like to play, and that we are at our most elevated as a life form, as a species, when we are playing. So you'll hear sports people talk about being in the purple patch, or being in the zone, or in the flow, when they're not thinking about what they're doing. They're just in it, they're just playing. And you can look at the brain waves and the stress hormones of people who are, you know, on a speed run of, you know, Sonic 2 or something, and they feel really relaxed, like their brains are where they need, their brains should be. That's what we've evolved to do. So homo ludensis, playing man, you know, we are, that's our species, we're meant to play. Ludic comes from the same root, so ludensis, ludic, ludo, the game. We play, it's about stimulation. A ludic loop is what happens when you pick up your phone and you check Twitter, and then you switch Twitter off and you check Facebook, and then you check email, and then you check BBC News, and then you check Twitter, and then you check Facebook.
This is therapy for me.
And there's a thing. It's a syndrome. Do
other people have this as well?
Everyone has it.
I'm really bad for this.
What Peter says is absolutely the right thing to do. Don't fill the gaps in the workday with random news and entertainment. Make sure you're longing to do something proactive. Take breaks and make sure it's a break from brain stimulation. Turn the smartphone off. Go and get a Nokia where the only thing you have is texting and Snake.
Snake is good.
An 8-day battery. and switch off. Switch off from things. You will get more done. Mike says...
But when in that process do you look at videos of cats?
There's a different name for that. That's the weird... emasculated ludic loop, because you're not a real man if you're looking at videos of cats. You should be looking at medieval combat reenactments. You weirdo.
On bikes.
So Mike says, Lifeograph. I've recently started a new job, and this simple tool enables me to store to-do lists and notes at the same place. I just have loads and loads of text files open and draft emails of notes saying, you know, do this, go to the doctors, buy peanut butter, etc. Duncan Murray says, the irony of me writing here is ridiculous. Anyway, someone needs to mention Emacs org mode. I don't actually use it at the moment, but it can do all the getting things done stuff with style, but requires a bit of commitment. personally, I use a desktop to-do list, to-do.txt, and a folder with files for each project I'm working on. Everything in there is a data log file of what I've done and what I need to sort out. That does require a bit of mental organization. Like you need to decide what the projects are, whereas I just have one file, and then I delete stuff after I've done it. Brocker says, Wecan, formerly Libre board, is a pretty nice Trello-like. I've tried using Kanban boards before, but it never took. Wecan is sufficiently easy to work with and decent to look at to have made it a mainstay. Nextcloud has tasks and its own Trello-like called Dex. Anyone use Nextcloud?
I've used Nextcloud, but didn't realize it had its own Trello plugin.
No, nor did I. I use it as well, but nope, you learn something new every day.
Is Trello cool?
Is this cool?
I feel like Chris Murray's asking that question. Is Trello cool? Because I've used it and I just think it's awful.
I think it's the way that a lot of development teams in particular have to work for people to be able to get them into some kind of structure.
But it's so unstructured. And anybody can add a Trello board, anyone can add a Trello card. There's no... you could have...
Well, it's often linked. So it could be linked to GitHub issues, for example. You know, the issues are filed and then people take ownership over them and then people move them into their lanes when they're working on for their specific sprint. I think that's the way that a lot of people use them.
I think it's fairly unstructured in its sort of base form, but the idea is you generally apply some structure on top of that.
Yeah. We've never been good at structure.
No.
Well, David I says something very sensible here. He says, it's important to note that getting things done is not an organizational system. Getting Things Done, the book, was written to help you devise your own bespoke system that works for you as an individual. David Allen recommends that must be the author of this technique. David Allen recommends that you make your system so much fun that you actually enjoy using it. That's the key. I love and use org mode myself. Would stop using it in a heartbeat if it stopped being fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was just going to quickly say, with everybody raving about org mode, I do feel like I should invest time to learn it, but I would have to put that on my existing to-do list, and I'm not sure where I would put it. Like, learning org mode may help me fix the other things on my to-do list, but that will obviously require a few hours.
I think
hours.
You need to move it to the blocked column, Mike.
Am I the only person who's never got on with any computer organizational software thing and can only do it offline?
No, not at all.
I use pen and paper for this, and I've tried various things, but nothing works for me other than a blank notebook that I write in, and I have a to-do list, and every day I review what was on my to-do list for that day, see what I've done, see what I've decided is no longer important, see what I still need to do for the next day, and that.
But do you get the sort of cathartic, deep satisfaction of destroying a task from the list? Like, I use a web-based to-do manager, and you hit this button and you've done a task, it disappears, and you think, yes, that's gone forever.
No.
I mean, you could cut off the strips of to-do things and burn them or something, but I guess it's not the same.
I don't think I feel the need for that level of catharsis.
There's probably something wrong with me, actually, rather than anybody else.
But I think there's something about having it physically there that just doesn't... It's a thing. It's etched onto paper.
Yeah.
It's not just electrons in the ether. That means something in my brain somewhere.
If it's there on your desk, like on a actual piece of paper, you don't need to log into a system in the morning for it to be there. You don't need to opt into it. You don't need to. You don't need to make sure that your teammates, your co-workers are using the same version control system for it to show up properly in your Trello board. It's there. It's your responsibility, and it's And even if you scribble it out, it's not done, it's not gone, it's not zeroed from existence. It still exists, it's just got a line of ink through it. So you know it's, you know that you've done the task, but you have a sort of a physical reminder that you have achieved something.
Well, you're putting all your eggs in one basket there. What if the dog eats the
to-do list? Oh, you mean like my dog ate my passport last week, costing me £75?
Did he really?
Yeah.
Did he really?
Really did. My passport, brilliant. My passport became out of date. It had expired, so I paid my money and sent off for a new passport. Passport drops through the letterbox. Dog intercepts it. It's probably been made with this brand new Hindu unfriendly beef tallow paper, and which he finds absolutely irresistible.
With the Union Jack threaded through it.
Yeah, with little images of British birds and Farage on the
when when your dog started to eat it, was it a bit like Marty McFly in Back to the Future? Did your hand start to
Yeah, luckily I've sent off my £75 to the Under the Sea Dance, and Marvin Berry has discovered this new sound to send to his cousin Chuck, and everything should be okay. But I was pretty angry. I was pretty rageous. Well, anyway, those are
but imagine
finds and discoveries and imaginings. Sorry, Ben, what was that?
So imagine if it had eaten your to-do list and then you didn't even know you were going to go on holiday.
Yeah, imagine entrusting that part of your brain to software. What could go wrong, eh? So those are our thoughts and our neurons and our imaginings and discoveries. I'm pretty disorganized. I have a long list. If a list gets too long, I paste it into an email. Email it to myself and then delete the whole list.
And
start again. That's it. I don't have but that's part of.
You see, I write.
That's the joy of working from home and you know being your own boss and also being on the dole. You don't really need to fit in with anybody else's methodology.
I write a new list every day, and even if it includes lists from the previous day, I consciously have to write them on the new list. So that's that screening process of actually that was never needed to be done anyway. Ignore.
Yeah. Right, on my to-do list right now is to go downstairs and eat my dinner. So
yes.
I will bid everybody adieu and possibly see you all next fortnight.
Yep. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Au revoir.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
Cool. See ya. It's such a nice day. I'm not afraid to die.